Welcome to the Beverage Report podcast. Today we have with us Professor Matthew Stopka. Professor Stopka is our very own Professor of Economics at LSE and Professor of Economic History at Northwestern University, with his research exploring how decisions taken within families shape macroeconomic outcomes and how economic conditions feed back into what families do. He has published in leading international journals, including the American Economic Review, Econometrica, and the Quarterly Journal of Economics. His book, Love, Money, and Parenting, How Economics Explains the Way We Raise Our Kids, alongside Professor Zilibotti, is an international bestseller. Professor Stopka holds a PhD from the University of Chicago and is a recipient of an Alfred P. Sloan Research Fellowship.
So today we have with us Professor Matthias Stopka, and the first question to you, Professor, is what attracted you to family economics and what makes this a unique field?
So what attracted me to it was thinking about economic growth. When I was in graduate school, the biggest question we had in macroeconomics was, you know, why are some countries rich and why are some countries poor? And you know, it's not like we have completely figured this out, because then we would have no poor countries anymore. But at that time, the attention really shifted to demographics, you know, based on the observation that historically, if you look at the wider range of human history, the usual thing was not economic growth, but stagnation. You know, for most of history, most people were poor, close to starvation, literally, stunted often. One big insight, kind of very early in social science, was that this had to do with demographics. Essentially, the Malthusian insight that whenever people get a bit richer, population growth goes up, they have more children, and this is kind of what pushes people back down. And you know, why are we rich now? There's many reasons. There's a technological improvements, industrialization, but there's also demographic change. Now, people went from having large families and just putting the kids to work early on to having small families and investing a lot in their education and human capital. And so this demographic shift from large to small families was really a key part of wealth and our current living standards to be possible. And so understanding this in a broader growth context was the very first thing that brought me to families. And so that's how I came to work on the economics of fertility, and things started from there.
Awesome. And in your time working in this field, what have you found to be the most interesting specialty within this broad family economics term, right?
You know, there's many fun things to think about. What I find particularly interesting is this issue of bargaining. You know, most of the time in economics, we think of single decision makers, like a consumer who wants to decide how to allocate a budget, a firm that wants to maximize profit in some point, in some way. But in families, you're always with multiple people. It's a definition of a family. There's multiple spouses, there's children that interact with you, often with multiple generations. You know, in many cultures, you have older family members living, with the younger ones, and often, maybe the mother-in-law has a lot of say too. And so how this bargaining and negotiation gets resolved is, I think, super interesting. It's also something we need to learn a lot more about.
And on the point of families, in your best-selling book, Love, Money, Parenting, How Economics Explains the Way We Raise Our Kids, you explore the reverse causality of macroeconomic inequality in parenting decisions. So my first question there would be, what is the relationship between inequality and the parenting decisions on microeconomic and macroeconomic models?
Right, this is one of the first things we stumbled on when we came to work on parenting. Because what we wanted to understand is why parenting differs so much across time and space. So at the time, I had a co-author, for instance, Zilibotti, that we wrote this book with. He was living in Sweden, in Stockholm, and so he was raising his children in a very what we would call permissive environment, where kids have a lot of independence, they play on their own, and parents feel that it's really best for children to be left alone a lot, and you don't really try to push them into too many activities or early learning. Compare that to United States, where I was raising my kids, where it's a lot more intense, where kids are supervised most of the time, and where many parents try to really push them towards achievement early on, to have 3-4-year-olds study to read and write and do arithmetic and maybe pick up the violin at the same time. So very different parenting style. And so, it occurred to us, maybe there's some economic dimension to this. Yep. And so we started to look at various things, including inequality. What we noticed is that not just this contrast of Sweden and the United States, which are a bit of cartoon cases, but really across a wide range of countries, you see that low inequality countries like Sweden have more permissive, kind of relaxed parenting styles. The high inequality countries like the United States, but also China, many places like Turkey, you know, kind of in the middle income range, have a lot more authoritarian or kind of intensive parenting styles. And so we try to understand the economics behind this.
And what makes an economist's perspective on parenting decisions different from a sociologist or, you know, some other social science field?
Right. And this is a really good question to ask, because these are issues that all social sciences work on a lot.
Yeah.
You know, some other social scientists might question, you know, whether economists have useful things to contribute, and that's certainly something we have to think about. You know, and for sure, it is an area where we have to learn a lot from the other fields. And Fabrizio and I and our other co-authors really do try to keep up with the literature. But at the same time, I do think that we have a unique perspective, which really has two parts to that. And I think kind of the key part is that in economics, our starting point, not always the only thing we do, but our starting point is to say that we think of human behavior as the people, broadly speaking, people broadly speaking knowing what they're doing. Now, we think that people have certain objectives, you know, their preferences, and their behavior is explained by trying to get those objectives in a way that's shaped by the constraints that they face, you know, the budget constraints, but also the wider constraints from society. Compared to other social scientists who, relatively speaking, have more the view that behavior is maybe less of a kind of rational choice and more driven by conventions and constraints that society imposes on you directly. So we have this other perspective that people, broadly speaking, know what they're doing. A second part is also a bit how we look at data. You know, so we talked a bit about it at the very beginning, that when economists think about economic growth, we are very comfortable with thinking that people in very different places and also in very different historical periods still are comparable, you know, because they are all trying to do the best, say, for their children or for their own well-being, and we just have to look at how these places differ to understand those differences. So we take a very broad view of taking evidence from many places together, whereas, I mean, this of course happens in all social scientists, but relatively speaking, the other social sciences, in particular psychology, are often a bit more micro-empirical, where a lot of the evidence comes from, say, comparative studies of a set of families in a particular time and space, which is also very informative, but it's a different way of looking at the data, and I feel we can contribute by bringing our perspective to the data.
Interesting. And you mentioned your experience of raising kids in America, but, you know, more generally, with higher inequality, there's more pressure on children to upskill at a very early stage. What sort of institutional change can tackle this pressure, the societal pressure on children?
Right, so in our work, we argue that this pressure on children is, broadly speaking, a reasonable response of the parents, because the returns to education have gone up so much. You know? So now it makes a huge difference or not if you went to a college in the United States or university here. The gap between rich and poor has risen, and that means that these stakes are very high. You know? So if you fail to get your child the skills that make them succeed, you know, then it's just a bigger issue than it would have been in the past. And so to that extent, you say that some of this is really economic inequality, which kind of tells you that, well, you know, policies that that counteract rising inequality in general, you know, would be helpful. And this includes, of course, redistribution policies, but also policies that specifically support skill accumulation among groups that are maybe kind of less wealthy and well off and in an easy position to do it all by themselves. So that would also help. However, it's not really just the overall economic picture, but it's also particular institutional details. Now, for example, if you think about the particular pressures that children are under, some of which are shaped by very deliberate choices in the design of the education system. Now, you have some education system in which there is tracking, where at some age kids are put into kind of an academic and a non-academic track, and that tends out to be a very high stakes decision, where kind of, you know, parents and children really get stressed a lot about how to jump that bar. If you make a system that's more integrated and where there's more, you know, ways to cross the different tracks later on, that pressure goes down a little bit. And it's similar with university admissions. You know, if you have a system that is very much has elite institutions that are very hard to get into, maybe with high stakes admissions tests, of course that creates pressure, you know, in high school, which is not very much obvious to anybody who raises children in the United States right now. If you live in a country where universities are, you know, more level in quality, you know, so in, say in Germany, you know, there's many public universities which are good, but there's not one outstanding one like, you know, an Ivy League institution, that relieves some of this pressure. It doesn't really say that one of the or the other policy is the right one, because there's multiple trade-offs involved, but it does say that the design of our education system has important repercussions for how families live their lives.
And you briefly mentioned earlier that broad changes, that's what economists actually look at. So how do the intergenerational differences in parenting decisions are affected by the decline in the fertility in OECD countries and China?
Right, so there's a few different dimensions to this, but I mean, maybe the most important one is that the decline in fertility really makes more intensive parenting possible, because there's just so much more time per child going around, you know. So even now, if you have we have three children now, and anybody with three children will recognize that you tend to spend a lot of less time on the third child than the first, just because you don't have the time anymore. You know, the first ones take up time; you have to do your job still, so time goes away. So if you have a situation where many families have three or four children, it's just not going to be possible to have kind of the same intensity of parenting that, say, parents in Shanghai, you know, under the one-child policy had, where every family has one child, and if this is for two generations, that means also every child has four grandparents at their sole disposal, and so there is essentially, you know, six adults per child available, which of course gives you a whole different, you know, set of possibilities and constraints than in a situation with higher fertility.
You also mentioned the Scandinavian countries and the parenting styles in those nations. I'm wondering, what's the external validity of Scandinavian parenting styles to countries with a large population like the United States?
Right, so, and that's really a good question, because you might think that some of this is really kind of because of culture or because these countries are small, and so wonder, you know, could in principle the same outcome happen in a bigger country too? One thing, no, it's hard to know for sure. One thing we see in the data is that if you look at changes in inequality within a country over time, you get essentially the same gradient, you know, the same change in parenting behavior that we see across countries. So even in Sweden, for example, inequality has risen, and it's still a very kind of permissive and liberal country, but not so much as it was 30 years ago. You know? Or look, if you look inside Germany, you see that I was raised in a very permissive climate in the 70s, and when I say permissive, I mean in the sense of the parenting style, you know, that essentially kids had a lot of independence. And that has also changed. You know? So now the Germans are not as intense as the Americans, but they have certainly moved, let's say, halfway to that start. You know? And so seeing these same changes within countries as across countries kind of very much suggests that economic change in any given country could give you this whole range of possible parenting outcomes.
Interesting. And moving gears a bit, in your paper, It Takes a Village, the economics of parenting with the neighborhood and peer effects, you say that the children's interactions with their peers dominates the parents' direct impact as they reach adolescence. My question to you then being is, what is the significance of this result from a policy perspective that you were discussing earlier as to, you know, how education policy impacts parenting decisions? How does this play a role in that overall picture?
Right. So now we're talking a bit about a later stage. Now, when you think of, say, teenagers, you know, then we're in the phase where peer effects are super important, because, you know, they just care more about their peers, they're more oriented towards them than towards their parents. What we point out in this paper is that parents, you know, being aware of that, you know, still have some influence, and they really have influence on peer selection. And you know, there's many decisions like that. The most important ones are things like residential choice, you know, which neighborhood do I want to live in, because that determines what families are around me. Which school do I sign my kid up for? And again, you know, it shapes the peer group. Also kind of more subtle things like activities. You know, if I sign my kid up at age six, you know, for, let's say, the violin versus American football, I'm going to have different groups of children and parents in there that will have some impact on the future. Now, so that's saying, you know, parents play an important role in this, and the paper kind of argues, just like other parenting choices, we can think of those as being broadly, you know, rational, you know, in the sense that parents become kind of more interventionist when, say, inequality in peers goes up a lot, and they feel the stakes are higher, you know, in kind of really shaping this decision. Now, where does it matter for policy? Well, it matters for policy because often we have policy interventions that are also designed to affect peer effects. Now, think again of residential sorting. You know, many policymakers have views on how this should work out. Now, for example, some might have the view that there should be more integration, there should be affordable housing in rich neighborhoods so that rich and poor can live together and benefit from integration. You have policies that have to do with school choice. You know, are we going to have private schools supported or not? Do we, for example, allow schools to select children by ability or on other characteristics? And these are kind of controversial choices. Now, what our analysis implies is that if you would understand the implications of those policies, you really have to take into account how parents are going to react, because the parents are also players in this game, and they will react to this. Now, if you tell parents, well, we're going to kind of remix all the children, put them in this particular peer group, well, then the parents might have some reaction that tries to offset that. For example, if you try to integrate schools in, say in a United States city, then parents might say, well, this new peer group is not very attractive to us, we're not going to move to the suburbs. Which, of course, is something that happened in reality a lot when we had these busing policies in the 1970s. You know? So it says that policy cannot really ignore the parental reaction. We have to kind of take that interaction into account.
And how did the results of your paper change when you look at COVID, right? When the interactions with the peers were severely limited as children move on to a remote learning environment.
Right. And so that's a paper we wrote about the impact of this recent crisis. And the somewhat depressing outcome of that paper is that kind of all channels you consider really signal that educational inequality is bound to rise. You know? And so in terms of peer effects, there is some direct evidence that kids that are struggling in school suffer more from disruptions in peer effects. So there's such an impact. You have your friends and now you can't contact them anymore, that will have some psychological impact. How does this affect your learning? And that's just like higher in kids that are already, you know, having, say, lower grades and starting a bit. The second thing is, who's your peer group going to be? You know? So now you are not going to school because schools are closed in the United States often for more than a year. The peer groups you have remaining, if at all, it's going to be local. You know, it's going to be kind of in your neighborhood. And so it depends a bit on the degree of inequality in schools versus neighborhoods. In the United States, which is the case we looked at, neighborhoods are a lot more segregated than schools are. And so you're going to have more inequality in peer effects during the pandemic than after. So this will also amplify this education inequality, kind of so a larger downward effect on the kids that are already struggling and less so on the kids that were doing well previously. And on top of this, you also have additional effects, not about peer effects. Perhaps the most important one is that what really matters is the parents' ability to help the children, you know, partly to the extent that they understand the material. Of course, it could be an issue with, say, high school math, but more importantly, the availability of time. And so that they're the biggest dividing line is whether the parents have occupations that allow them to work from home, or they have to be at some workplace because they, say, are in manufacturing or in some place where you have to kind of show up at a place of work. Yeah. And now just the basic fact is that higher educated, well-paid parents tend to have office jobs that you can do from home, like, you know, university faculty where we all were sitting on Zoom at home. And so that again gives, on average, another advantage to the kids that were already doing better. So for all of these reasons, education inequality rose very substantially, and that's something we, I think, still haven't really begun to address in terms of how to counteract this in the coming years.
And does this increase in education inequality, does it have a lasting effect, or was it just periodic?
Well, it's interesting to see in the future, because the models we have very much suggest that this is going to be a permanent effect. You know, that once you fall behind, it's very difficult to make up for this loss. In principle, it's possible if you had a huge investment, say, in one-on-one tutoring, but if that's not happening, then and you just go back to school at the regular rate, you might continue learning, but you will not make up for this loss. And that's certainly very obvious for kids that were very close to finishing. You know, if you were like 1 year, say, before finishing school and thinking about applying to university. And so think of a kid that is kind of on the margin. You know, maybe they apply, maybe they don't, maybe they make it, maybe they don't. If you now get pushed down because you don't learn for a year, you're much more likely now not to make that step. You know, and so your education will be permanently affected. What's interesting to see is that the models we have predict that even for kids that were much younger, that were maybe in first or second grade, even for those kids, you should see a big impact. You know, 16 years later, 12 years later, you know, when they hit that end of school and potentially move on to tertiary education, and so, you know, seeing what actually happens to those cohorts will be quite interesting to, you know, test those models also.
Interesting. So moving on, I guess my next question would be. In your report, The Economics of Fertility, A New Era, you argue that the high-income countries, the income-fertility relationship has flattened and in some cases reversed. And the cross-country relationship between women's labor force participation and fertility is now positive.
has a disproportionate loss of women's employment during COVID and the consequent quick turnaround tested the weight of the new fertility era choice determinants, which you outlined in the paper that you identified?
Yes, I think it will be a super interesting test. The data is really just starting to come in, so we'll see what's going to happen there. But the basic insight of this paper, which is a survey and which summarizes a lot of research in economics and also sociology in recent years, is that today the way fertility works is that most women have, you know, common objectives, you know, and when I say most women, I mean around the world in many countries, which is both have a family and have a career. Now, so the most women could certainly aspire to have children, not every single one, but it's you know, still a very common wish to have a family, but also pretty much everybody, you know, women and men alike, want to have some success in a career and some fulfillment in a career. And so we argue that what really explains fertility differences across countries now is how compatible these goals are. So in some places you have a lot of support for working families, in others you have less public support. The labor market might be different. There's also the issue of social norms. Now, there's some places where social norms prescribe that mothers have to do most of the work of raising children and fathers do very little. In others, there's, you know, a bit more gender equality. So all of these things matter. So now the pandemic comes in, and so you kind of wonder how this is going to affect things. And it's really affects in both directions at the same time, you know, because on the one hand, it's true that the pandemic for some time made the division of labor again more traditional, you know, because you had this huge increase in need for childcare, given that daycares were closed and schools were closed, somebody to take care of all those children, and it was mothers, and not so more so than fathers. You know? So mothers reduced their labor supply more than fathers did, and spent more time at home caring for kids. And so the kind of the step back in the compatibility of a Korean family potentially, you know, would widen this conflict again, lead to lower fertility rates, and maybe delay this transition. But the other thing, which I think is ultimately the more important one, is that the pandemic also gave us this huge rise in employment flexibility. But flexibility, I mean, kind of how flexibly can you respond in your job to, say, sudden need of childcare because you have a sick child. You know? There's a number of factors that go into this. You know, for example, how flexible is your schedule to begin with? Do you have very long hours? You know, in some jobs, the expectation for somebody who wants to have a successful career is to be always available, you know, and to work very long hours, not because it's, maybe not because it's super efficient, but just because you're trying to be kind of look you know, tougher than the next guy, you know, and outwork others, and maybe then, you know, go have drinks with the colleagues at night to kind of really signal I'm all about work. And that's a kind of a norm, a social norm at work that will also make it more difficult. And so all of these things matter. The thing that's perhaps the most important one empirically is whether you're able to telecommute, whether you're able to work from home. And because if you have a sudden childcare need, like a sick child, which happens all the time, you know, kids at home with a fever doesn't really need like attention minute by minute, but somebody has to be there. You know? And so if you're able to be flexible, respond to that, you're going to have an easier time. Now before, it used to be the case that flexible jobs usually were not the well-paid jobs and the most career-oriented jobs. But now with the pandemic, tons of jobs have been converted to be more flexible, including career positions. You know, many businesses have gone to flexible employment where maybe you come in for work one or two days per week to the office and do the other stuff flexibly from home or for wherever else you might be. And so this kind of massive increase in employment flexibility in principle makes it a lot easier to have, say, a two-career family where both dads and mothers, you know, have career objectives, spend some time at home, so they're able to also take care of the family, but they can kind of do both at the same time. Compared to the previous model, where it was really difficult to have two business jobs, and so this conflict would then often leave women behind. So I think the potential is that this lasting increase, and the important thing is that data very much suggests that this change is there to stay, that people don't want to go back to 5 days in the office. That this will be a real opportunity to have an easier time to get a Korean family together. It will therefore be, you know, good for fertility among those who have those objectives.
And so, coming on to a more personal question, you have three sons. How has your research guided your parenting decisions?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question because on the one hand, you know, we take this economic perspective that people kind of do the right thing given the circumstances. You know, so I kind of should say, you know, it doesn't really make a difference, you know, because we were already optimizing. You know? At the same time, I mean, if you look at the data, it does impress on you how wide the range is in which children are raised. You know, if you're in a given society, in a given time and place, you kind of look around, everybody's doing the same thing, you kind of get the sense, well, this is the only way I have to do the same thing as everybody else. But yeah. If you look at the data on your travel a bit, you see, no, there's really a wide range of choices which are all viable. You know? And so I think one thing it does, it makes you a bit more relaxed, and it also, you know, does make you want to choose, I think, some features that I think are just nice, both for parents and children, such as more independence. You know? So this thing they do in Sweden, also in Japan, for example, to just give more freedom to kids, let them go on their own, to shopping, to visit friends, to, you know, play football at the park. We certainly try to do a lot more than that compared to our American neighbors, you know, based to some extent on what I'd seen in the research.
Interesting. We briefly touched upon Japan. I'm curious as to how the fertility decisions in Japan and China, which have a declining population, how does that impact the long-run parenting decisions? You know, that's beyond just the direct impacts.
As you know, so these are interesting challenges because they're facing a rapid demographic decline, you know? So yeah. You have fertility rates way under 2, so young cohorts are a lot smaller than old cohorts, and that will give you problems with sustaining social insurance, you know, paying for pensions and paying for healthcare. So we have to see how this plays out. I would not be surprised if, you know, given the kind of dire consequences for survival of the nations, you know, that Paul's really try to push against this, you know, and they're trying in some places with subsidies that will probably have to do kind of more radical things in terms of really making family and work life more compatible. But, you know, it does change the whole balance of the families. You know, it used to be that families had lots of kids, a few parents, and not many old people. Now it's going to be the other way around, you know, and so the dynamics of that will certainly have quite an impact on what family life feels like. I think we see it the most in China, where we have we've had the one-child policy for a long time, and one thing you see there is that that there is now a huge amount of grandparents' involvement in raising children, because often you have two parents who have careers. It's not a very flexible workplace, and so often they have to work long hours. But you have the grandparents, and there's again 4 grandparents per child, yeah, that take care of the children. So it's actually not unusual that the children would be raised primarily by the grandparents, and would see their parents only occasionally, you know, just like, you know, say Victorian parents did 150 years ago. And so there can really be a shift in family models just because these demographic changes really change what these families look like, you know, and I think we're seeing the very beginnings of that now.
And what should the future of family economics research look like, in your opinion?
You know, there's a lot of things to be done. I think I touched at the very beginning on this issue of bargaining, and I think this is something that we don't understand very well yet. You know, parenting is not about conflict, but being in a relationship is about conflict too. You know, often you agree, and but not always, and how you resolve disagreements in the family is important to understand. We have some beginnings of that, but I think we have a long way to go to kind of a complete understanding, even more so when it comes to extended families. Because I think one thing we really want to do is to apply family economics not just to, you know, say high-income couples in Sweden, the United States that we have talked about today, but also to families in lower-income countries. You know, and their extended families are very important. You have strong connections to, say, grandparents, but also horizontal connections to kind of members of the extended family. And so, for example, in many places where the extended family is important, if you have economic success, there would be cousins coming to you. I'm saying, well, maybe you should share some of this wealth. Maybe I want to live in your house. Maybe I want a job at the business that you founded successfully. You know? And so these interactions at a wider range in the family, I think, are quite important for development, and we're just beginning to understand them a bit better.
And what's your hypothesis as to how these bargaining decisions play out into the long-run economic growth?
You know, so one conjecture, say, in this issue that's mentioned is that there can be a tax on development. You know, if you have a social norm that requires insurance and sharing of resources in the extended family,
yeah,
you know, that of course helps to insure against shocks. But it also reduces incentives to be really successful because, you know, the wealth will be very widely shared. You know? So what I want to examine to some extent is whether this insurance of the wider family could also be a hindrance for development because of the incentive effects that it has. That's one example. Of course, in the wider scheme of things, we think the most important thing that families do is invest in the education, human capital of the children, because that's really the engine of growth, you know, for modern economies. And so also how these wider decisions factor into that, you know, what the children learn is the other part that's very important.
Interesting. And the main audience for this podcast is students. Mm-hmm. So what advice would you have for students who are interested in family economics?
You know, I think it's a super exciting field. It's a field that brings together empirics and theory, and it's, you know, what I particularly like about it is it also brings in some introspection. You know, I think social science is fun to some extent because we can relate to this stuff personally. You know, we all have families, we all have stories, how things fall out. So being able to bring that together is an exciting part. So I certainly encourage people to join this growing field where you can use all the different skills and some personal insights together.
And my final question to you is, what gives you hope?
It's a great question, especially in our times, you know, which sometimes look a bit depressing, you know, with a rising political polarization. We just went through the pandemic, we have, yeah, you know, Brexit fallout, inflation and strikes to deal with over here. At the same time, for me, the pandemic, you know, does give you a lot of reasons for hope. You know, and I think two examples of that. First is just human ingenuity, you know. So the vaccine, you know, is now, I know, controversial. People have become more skeptic. But if you kind of really think about what happened, you know, you had this pandemic. I think it took like you know, just weeks, you know, from the essential isolation of what the coronavirus was to you know, on a computer with genetic sequencing techniques, different teams design potential vaccine candidates, and then, you know, less than a year for those to be tested in clinical trials. It's just an enormous underachievement, and it really builds on insights that are just really new, you know, kind of in terms of genetics, in terms, yeah, of the idea of RNA vaccines, you know. So seeing this come together, and then, you know, I remember vividly in the, I think it was in December of 2020, when they showed the first clinical trial results, yeah, and you just saw how amazingly strong and effective, you know, this vaccine was for this original version of the virus. I think that's just amazing, you know, that science came up with a thing which, without question, saved many millions of lives. And people have gotten somehow a bit sour on it, you know, because we don't see the counterfactual, but I think we just have to say, you know, it's really an example of the amazing things, you know, human ingenuity can achieve. And more widely, if you look at the changes in society, you know, kind of during the pandemic, I think, again, often we look at the world and become a bit depressed about the possibility of change. So of course, now, yeah, climate change is the biggest issue, perhaps, that we face, and younger people, with, you know, good reason, kind of look at the old people and say, you guys never change, you're not listening, you know, the world seems to be stationary, you know? And often the world looks like this, but you kind of have to keep in mind that, it's not really, it's often, but it's not always, and sometimes the world really does change very quickly, and there really is a big possibility for change. You know, in my personal history, so I lived through German unification. It was a, you know, a thing where you had people separated, and you know, we certainly all thought this would be there forever. And then somehow people start protesting, the political situation lines up in the right way, and just like, you know, 6 months, the world totally changes. You know, and I think we saw this in the pandemic too, that even long before vaccines, you know, I mean, we went to a system where we had social distancing, you know, just because people essentially voluntarily, you know, changed their lives, infection rates kind of fell tremendously, you know, in those first months. Energy use went down tremendously, you know. So we talk about the possibility of an energy transition. COVID proved that if you really want to, we can completely change the way we live, even on a very small time scale. It's not easy to implement, you know, because political action is difficult, and there's millions of people who have to coordinate. But the possibility for human society bringing enormous change for the better, I think that was really underlined by the pandemic. And that gives me a lot of hope for the next challenges that we are facing.
Awesome. Thank you so much, mate.
Thank you. That was great.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Beverage Report podcast, interviewing our very own Professor Matthias Dubke of the LSE. We definitely recommend you check out Love, Money and Parenting, How Economics Explains the Way We Raise Our Kids. And to access more Professor Dubke's publications and interviews, please visit his website at faculty.wcas.northwestern.edu/MDO738.
If you found this episode interesting, please tune in to our other episodes on Spotify or on our website. And if you have any suggestions or feedback for us, please reach out over email to a.kaur8@lse.ac.uk. Until next time, thank you again and goodbye.